Sally found a pretty dress for my sister to wear. I gathered a bouquet of spring flowers and returned to find Sally mending my sister's garments in the places they'd been worn, swiping at her eyes so that she could see her own needle. They were all crying. The servants, the menfolk, the children. But I didn't cry. I didn't cry because my sister had bade me not to. I didn't cry when they put my sister in her coffin. I didn't cry when they lowered her into the ground near my mother. I didn't cry when they shoveled dirt on top of her. Nor did I cry when my father clutched at me by the fireplace, murmuring, "I've lost the half of all I had. Now it all hangs on the slender thread of a single life. On you, Patsy. Only you." He no longer had the strength, I think, to rage violently in his grief. There'd be no smashed glass, no overturned lamps, no splinters of tables left in his wake, and no pistols so long as I was there. It was as it had been at the beginning. Papa and I were forged together in sadness, and were still forged, such that no other person in this world was so dear. My life, too, was suspended by the slender thread of his, so I understood the truth of what he was saying. And yet, it was not the whole truth of it either. I had a family, and he had his mistress, and with her they had children. And I was never so grateful for Sally as I was that night when she relieved me at my father's side. I began to retch the moment I returned to my room. I heaved dryly into a pail that my husband held under me, nothing coming up. Alarmed to see me in such a state, Tom said, "Let me get you into bed." "No," I said, refusing to let him tend me. I couldn't lean on him. I was in too much pain. I could neither sit nor lie down anywhere without agony. Instead, I paced, panting like a horse that had been run too hard, until I was struggling for every breath the way my sister had struggled for hers. "My poor Patsy," Tom said, "you're having a fit of hysterics." Dragging in a ragged, desperate breath, as I tried to escape the cage of his arms, I snapped, "It's nothing of the sort. I ate radishes and milk together for supper, both of which are unfriendly to my stomach." "It can't be healthful to hold the pain the way you do. You're a woman. There's no shame in your tears. You need a good cry on my shoulder, Patsy." "Would you mind terribly fetching me some peppermint?" With a frown, he sighed, then went down the stairs. I shut the door behind him, gasping, suffocating in my own garments and struggling to tear them off. Something finally tore inside me, too, and I began to sob. I sobbed as I'd never sobbed before, falling to my knees amidst the shreds of my garments, shattered by the knowledge that I'd never see my sister again. She'd been 25 years old, now gone from me forever. And it was a pain like nothing I'd ever felt before, one I scarcely knew how to survive. "It's so hard to lose a sister," Nancy Randolph was saying. She'd come to Edge Hill ostensibly to offer her help in my time of grief. Now she was trying to draw me out past the usual pleasantries, because the Randolphs seemed to want to speak about everything. But I was a Jefferson, and I could scarcely hear my own infant daughter Mary's name spoken aloud without bleeding anew for the sister I'd named her after. Condolences came from all over the country. We even received one from Abigail Adams. But I didn't want to think about the loss. Couldn't bear to think about it. So I just stood there hanging laundry while my infamous sister-in-law nattered on, insensible to the fact that I was barely listening. "I know it's not the same," Nancy said, "but I've lost my sister Judy as sure as if she'd died. Truly I have. She harbors nothing but bitterness against me now. I imagine I might be bitter, too, if my sister had fornicated with my husband, then killed the bastard born of that incestuous union, and exposed us all to scandal and poverty. Nancy had no one left alive to blame but herself." So I said nothing, just hung a petticoat on the line. Handing me another wet petticoat from the basket, Nancy said, "John's causing mischief between us." John Randolph, she meant, the only surviving brother at Bazaar. John was a sharp-tongued dandy who'd lately taken to calling himself Randolph of Roanoke. I disliked him immensely, because he'd also taken to criticizing my father's presidency. But I didn't see how he could be to blame for the estrangement of Nancy and Judith, and I said so. "I'll tell you how," Nancy explained. "John falsely accused me of carrying on with slaves in my sister's house as if I lived in a tavern. He's saying I poisoned Richard, and he's giving Judith the excuse she needs to turn me out." For years now, I'd held my tongue about the scandal at Bazaar, even though my blood still ran cold at the thought of a dead baby hidden under a woodpile. Now, with grief eating me alive, I couldn't hold my tongue one moment longer. "Does Judy need an excuse, Nancy? We all know the kind of desperate acts you're capable of." Nancy drew back, pale as the petticoat on the line.
I thought you knew the truth, Patsy. I thought that's why, at trial, that's why you said..."
My blood ran even colder at the thought of her lying to me again after all these years. So I said nothing. But Nancy sputtered,
"You think I'm guilty. You think I killed my baby. But if you believed I was guilty, then why..."
"I didn't want to see you hanged," I said very quietly. Nancy let out a cry, as disconsolate as if I'd turned against her before the entire tribunal.
"You don't understand, Patsy. I wanted to confess from the start, but Richard wouldn't let me. He wanted to protect me. It's true that I surrendered my virtue to the man I loved. It's true. But I did nothing to harm the child, and neither did Richard. I swear it."
"Do you forget that I saw the herbs?" Nancy blinked.
"You can't think they were mine. It was always Judith who had my mother's way in the garden. I was never any good with herbs."
That was true, and the whole world realigned under my feet as I remembered it. Tears spilled over Nancy's cheeks, her lips trembling.
"Judith notices everything, always has. She knew I was pregnant before I did. She put the gum in my tea. I didn't know what I was drinking, Patsy."
Had Judith noticed from the start her husband's attraction to her sister? Had she given her sister the herbs to be rid of her husband's bastard? As I asked myself these questions, Nancy was near hysterical, more than a decade's worth of anguish bubbling to the surface.
"When you testified that you gave me the gum for an upset stomach, I thought it was because you didn't want anyone to know what Judith had done."
In shock, the freshly laundered undergarment fell from my grasp into the dirt, but I didn't stoop to retrieve it. Instead, I shivered, wondering if I'd somehow saved the wrong sister from the gallows. "But she defended you, Nancy. She defended both of you.
How else was she to cover up the crime of killing my baby?"
Nancy asked.
"Judy wanted both of us to pay, me and Richard, both. You have no idea what it was like returning to that house. Richard finally told her he intended to divorce her, and lo and behold, 2 days later he was dead of cramps in his stomach. But John blames me for bringing disgrace on the family, and I think she has him convinced that if Richard was poisoned, it was my doing.
Richard Randolph's death had been strange. But then, everything about the people of Bizarre Plantation specifically and Tom's family generally was strange. Still, I couldn't wrap my mind around it.
What you're saying, Nancy, if you suspect these things of your own sister, why did you stay with her at Bizarre all this time?
Nancy gave a bitter laugh.
I'm a spinster sister with a blackened name. I had nowhere else to go. The Harveys would never have me at Tuckahoe. I knew you'd never have me in your household. Besides, how was I to leave until one of my brothers came for me? Judith reads all my letters coming or going. No one visits Bizarre since the scandal. Even those willing to associate with me, Judith keeps away, claiming pecuniary embarrassment. Every night, Judith takes out her Bible and makes me pray forgiveness for every little gift or kindness Richard ever bestowed on me. She employs me with drudgery every day and locks me in my bedroom at night. I've been so guilt-ridden, I could hardly complain. I felt as if I deserved it, especially since now I'm nothing but an object of charity.
I didn't want to believe her. I didn't want to believe a word. Yet it had the ring of truth to it. And tenderness for Nancy stole over me at the thought she'd been silently suffering. We'd been taking care of Tom's younger sisters for years, and I didn't know how we'd afford another, or how our reputation would endure the scandal, but I said, "Stay here for a spell, Nancy." Smearing tears with the back of her hands, Nancy said,
"You can't mean it."
"I do." It took her a moment to believe me. When she did, she threw her arms around my neck.
"You're so kind. My brother is so fortunate to have you for a wife. Never did there exist a more excellent woman, and you won't be sorry. I'll be a helper for you, and a sister in truth, a new sister for the one you lost."
Chapter 30. Washington, 1st of July, 1805. From Thomas Jefferson to Robert Smith, United States Secretary of the Navy. "You will perceive that I pled guilty to one of their charges, that when young and single I offered love to a handsome lady. I acknowledge its incorrectness. It is the only truth among all their allegations against me." This letter is a denial of Sally, or at least it will be read as one, which is why I don't burn it, even though it contains an admission of dishonor. The handsome lady my father attempted to seduce was Mrs. Walker, and I learned of the incident in the spring of 1805 when, after having been re-elected to the presidency, my father sent to me at Edgehill a carefully sealed letter in the care of my husband, with instructions that it should be delivered directly into my hands and shown to no other. I'd never received such a mysterious letter, folded quite small, heavy with its wax seal, and it was a letter that struck terror into my heart, because it was a message of love and repentance and farewell. "Get me a horse," I said to the nearest servant, still clutching the letter as I left my babies in their beds and rushed out of the house. I was up and into a saddle without so much as a cloak before Tom could stop me. "What the devil are you doing?" he shouted after me. "Patsy, you can't go riding off into the night. It's dusk. I'll take you to your father in the morning."
"Monticello is only a few miles," I said, kicking my heels into the horse's side.
Tom shouted for his own horse as I galloped off, but I never looked back. Instead, I rode with the sureness of the trained horsewoman I'd nearly forgotten I had inside me, racing up Papa's Mountain like Jack Jewett did in raising the alarm that the British were coming. breathless by the time I swung down in front of my father's house, and still stinging from the lash of tree branches, I hurried into the entryway. "Sally!" I called, but heard no answer. And in a place like Monticello, where it was never quiet, I found myself instantly alarmed. I found Papa, secretly returned from Washington City, alone at his table with a glass of sherry, perusing a box of curiosities from Captains Meriwether Lewis and William Clark, whom he'd sent on a grand expedition. Inside the chest were the preserved skeletons of all manner of creatures, wolves, weasels, and elk. And I had a sudden memory of my father in his much younger days, feverishly scribbling down the correct way to preserve dead birds.
"Patsy."
He shook his head, as if he wished I hadn't come. I fought for both breath and composure. "Papa, you can't just send me a letter like that and—"
"Spoken words fail me where my pen rarely does."
I held the back of a gilded chair for steadiness. "You cannot mean to fight a duel." Just the summer before, my father's old nemesis had died in a duel. Alexander Hamilton was dead before the age of 50, and it was my father's vice president who killed him. Hamilton, whose reputation had also been sullied by the revelation of an affair with a married woman, had tangled with Aaron Burr, who demanded satisfaction upon a field of honor. And as if seeking an end to his life, Hamilton dueled upon the very same spot where his son had died, using the very same pistols. Blood for reputation. Blood for honor. And now my father intended to follow in his footsteps. "You're the President of the United States. Surely you don't intend to dignify—"
"It's true, Patsy," my father broke in. "I did try to seduce Mr. Walker's wife. It happened before you were born or conceived, before your mother. I regret that you should have to know the truth of it."
After all the other truths to which I was privy, did he really think this truth would matter to me? He clearly condemned himself, because his posture was stiff, tortured, and guilty indeed. Guiltier, I think, than when I asked him to deny Sally Hemings. He believed he had a right to his relationship with Sally. In some ways, he'd become defiant about it, allowing her to name their new baby James Madison Hemings after both her beloved brother and my father's closest political ally. If Papa felt shame for Sally anymore, he never showed it. But this matter with Mrs. Walker was something else altogether, because he had lied to me. He had told me that his quarrel with the Walkers had arisen over money matters, a thing I had repeated, unwittingly fanning the flames of the scandal. Now he stood shamed for that, and I could see, in the bleakness of his eyes, that he feared an irreparable breach between us. Poor Papa. Didn't he know that a breach between us was not possible? Taking a deep breath, I pulled the crinkled letter from the bosom of my dress where I'd tucked it away. "What matter can it possibly make that it's true? I'm happy to throw your confession on the fire and forget such an incident, as you should." Papa gave a slight shake of his head.
"For years I've tried to suppress the stories. Alas, they in the papers now, saying I made a cuckold of Mr. Walker. He's demanding satisfaction."
What a farce to imagine my elderly father taking up his pistols to duel with the elderly Mr. Walker over a matter nearly 40 years in the past. Let Mr. Walker demand satisfaction. You don't have to give it to him. My father downed his sherry in one gulp, something I'd never seen him do before.
"Mr. Madison has already attempted to negotiate a peaceful resolution. I'm afraid it cannot be escaped this time."
This was madness. We lived in a world where a sitting vice president had murdered the former secretary of the treasury. That my father should open himself up to die the same way, shot over some trivial matter, was tempting fate's sense of irony. That I had judged Alexander Hamilton to be an intemperate man, my father was, in almost all matters, a man of cool reason. How could he let himself be goaded to such foolishness? Perhaps he didn't require much goading. Once, I'd put myself between him and his pistols. Perhaps now that my sister was dead, he was still, after all this time, trying to keep an appointment with them. Dragging a chair close to my father, I collapsed into it, then took his aging hand in mine, the one that had been broken and disfigured for foolishness in France over a different married woman. "Papa, I'll never let you do this thing." His chin bobbed up. He was the president, the most powerful man in the country and the master of his own destiny. Who could stop him from doing anything? Certainly it wasn't the place of a daughter to tell a father what he must or must not do. But it was my place. It had always been my place to pull him back from the abyss. Perhaps he knew it, because his expression crumbled. "Oh, Patsy. You wrote to me because you knew I'd never let you duel Mr. Walker. So what does he want other than your blood?" My father's shoulders rounded and drooped.
"He wants me to publicly admit my fault and declare his wife innocent, which she was. She rebuffed my advances. The wrongdoing was entirely mine."
"Perhaps, then, you ought to confess it." I'd advised him to deny Sally Hemings. But Mrs. Walker was a white woman, and the circumstances were not ongoing. An appeal to pragmatism was unlikely to move him, given his guilty heart. So I argued, "Admit it for Mrs. Walker's sake. If she's innocent, a gentleman would do no less than clear her name."
His gnarled fingers tightened on mine, but he didn't answer.
"That will have to be enough for Mr. Walker, Papa, because dueling isn't for fathers or for those charged with other great moral concerns. Do you remember in Paris how you pleaded with me to choose you over a life in the nunnery, though I felt called by God?"
He nodded, made sheepish by the reminder.
"Well, you're only being called by Mr. Walker." My father sputtered in soft laughter and brought my hand to his lips to kiss.
"He's one of a thousand hounds baying for my blood."
He still felt besieged. He had virulent enemies in Congress, not least of whom was the pretentiously styled Randolph of Roanoke.
"I need you there with me, Patsy, in Washington City. I hesitate to ask it of you, because I know you've long wished that I wouldn't seek public office, but I need you with me."
"You must never hesitate to ask anything of me, Papa," I said, making my mind up at once. "Your father needs a first lady," Dolly Madison had once said to me. I hadn't wanted to hear it. I'd spent half my life resenting my father's political career. Why, I hadn't even congratulated him when he was elected to the presidency. Some part of my resentment was worry for how public service had dwindled our family fortune. Another part was the sullen memory of a young girl in France whose father answered her every political inquiry with silence. But I was no longer a girl, and he'd never dream of discouraging my political curiosity now. If anything, he filled his letters to me with all the news of the day to ensure I was informed. My father had changed, and so must I. My mother, in her final breaths, had tried to make me understand that my father was a great man. but he might not be remembered as one if his presidency failed. I couldn't let it fail. Not if everything my family had suffered and sacrificed were to mean something in the end. Papa and I were seated like that, close and affectionate, when Tom burst in the door. "Martha!" Tom cried, fixing me with a glower. Then to my father he said, "She rode out like a madwoman before I could stop her."
"Just in time to pull me back from the edge,"
Papa murmured. I'd always done it, and I always would. Tom didn't want me to go to Washington City. He had good reason, in that our financial situation was bleak. As a congressman, Tom only made $6 a day, and saved on expenses only by living in the president's house with my father and Jack Epps. Meanwhile, the Hessian fly had come to Virginia and laid waste to our wheat, leaving us nothing to sell and scarcely enough to make bread or lay grain away to feed us for the year. Tom's sister Jenny found an upright man to marry, which meant my husband felt honor-bound to pay an enormous dowry. And because Tom wasn't willing to sell Verena, our creditors were at the door. Add the fact that I was pregnant again, and my husband had good reason to worry about the expense of bringing his growing family to Washington City. By this time, baby Mary was talking. 6-year-old Cornelia was already an artist with her pencils. Whip-smart Ellen had moved on from Latin to debating with her grandpapa. Jeff was old enough to run errands but not yet strong enough to be a real help to his father. And my pretty Anne was now a lady of 14, of age to come out into society. They were growing up fast, faster than we could keep them clothed, in truth. Certainly not in a style befitting their status as the president's grandchildren. But to have me near, my father insisted on taking upon himself the entire expense of our trip. He sent half a dozen pairs of shoes for Anne. He had Dolly buy me hats and dresses and wigs for my hair. Tom didn't like it, and took my father's every generous gesture as a comment on his own inability to provide for his family in wealth and luxury. But I was overjoyed when he finally consented. "Thank you, Tom. It's going to mean so much to my father."
"I'm sure it will," he said, digging his hands down into his pockets. "But that's not why I'm allowing it. I'm taking you with me to Washington City because when your sister died, I cursed myself 1,000 times, knowing that it could have been you."
He gave an emphatic, pained shudder, repeating,
"It could have been you." Maybe Jack Epps can smile and laugh again now that his wife is more than a year in the ground. But that's not the man I am. If I should lose you, Patsy, it would destroy me. So I'll keep you with me in Washington City and watch over you in your pregnancy, even if it's financially unwise. Even if it should bankrupt us.
He said all this with his head hanging down, as if it unmanned him shamefully to confess such tender sentiments. But I was deeply moved. I supposed the same thing in his nature that made him so temperamental and morose was what let him pour out his heart in such a way. So I kissed his cheeks, one side, then the other, finishing with a tender kiss to his lips, that I hoped might tell him how my heart swelled to know his true feelings. Then I set out that autumn, 6 months pregnant, with all my children crowded together in a carriage, making our way slowly over bumpy roads to Washington City. "Look at the Capitol building," Ellen said, wrestling Cornelia to see out the window. "One day it will have a great dome atop it. Your grandfather designed this city, you know," I told my girls, and watched their eyes widen. Even now, when I look at the great capital Washington has become, I see the bones of it as my father laid them, and I marvel. But Jeff wasn't as impressed as his sisters by his grandfather's handiwork. He was merely disappointed that the mammoth cheese no longer occupied the downstairs of the president's house. Fortunately, my son gorged his curiosity on Papa's new camera obscura, which made silhouettes, and the collection of fossil bones my father had all in one room, displaying the artifacts of the America he was building and exploring. The capital had grown since I last visited, but the more important change was the society in which Dolly Madison now reigned as queen, spearheading numerous charity events at which people flooded about me, hanging unnaturally upon my every word. "Your father's plans are ambitious," Dolly explained. "They won't be passed without the support of the congressmen's wives. We'll have to win them over." I realized, after only a single luncheon, that these ladies were introducing a new version of the parlor politics I'd become so well acquainted with in France. When last I was here with my sister, I hadn't embraced the role Dolly had advised me to play. Not truly. That had been a mistake I intended to rectify. I couldn't rival Dolly's bright sense of fashion, especially when I was so big and round with child, but I ornamented my darker, more sedate gowns with yellow sashes and red ribbons and white bonnets with gauzy trim. I quietly informed the chef and the secretaries and staff that I'd be hostess at all my father's events from the moment Congress convened until it adjourned. From seating arrangements to etiquette, from soup to dessert wine to conversation and music, I took my place at my father's side, where he needed me, where I was meant to be. Early in December, my daughter excitedly pulled on long white gloves over her delicate arms and exclaimed, "I heard the guns from the frigate at the Navy Yard." It was to be Anne's first formal dinner in the president's house, one at which we'd greet the envoy from Tunisia. And though she could be a shy, tremulous thing, tonight Anne vibrated with excitement. "I've never met a Muslim."
"I've never met one either," I said. She turned to me, astonished.
"Not even in France?" I was charmed that my children seemed to believe I'd seen and done and knew everything because I'd been to France. What I did know about the visiting Tunisian envoy, Sidi Suleiman Meli Meli, was salacious. Dolly had whispered over tea that the ambassador was perfumed like a woman, and her husband had been obliged to provide concubines for the Tunisian delegation at a nearby hotel, which had set tongues wagging. Papa insisted that the cause of making peace with the Barbary pirates was too important for us to balk at the irregular conduct of their ministers. That's why I'd postponed dinner from late afternoon to after sunset in honor of the religious practice of Ramadan.
"We're to be the only ladies in attendance," my daughter asked. I nodded. Ambassador Meli Meli is unaccustomed to the calming presence of women in political society, and we'll have to ease him into it. There was much bowing and greeting when the ambassador and his two secretaries arrived, and upon seeing me and my daughter, he begged our pardon, through an interpreter, to retire to smoke his pipe.
"Feel free to smoke here," Papa said, and the gold and scarlet-clad ambassador stroked his long beard thoughtfully. Looking first to his two secretaries, who wouldn't partake of wine, he nodded, then lit his wonderfully unusual 4-foot pipe. I was painfully worried of giving offense, especially considering the company. Amongst our American guests, John Quincy Adams and our own snarling kinsman, Congressman Randolph of Roanoke.
After making snide quips, implying that my husband and Jack Epps held their congressional seats only through my father's influence, John finally leaned over to me at the table and whispered,
"I'm so glad you didn't bring the vampire with you."
"I beg your pardon?"
"Nancy," he hissed. "She's sucked the best blood of my race."
Whether he was accusing her of murdering his brother or making some lewder accusation, I couldn't guess. "I'm sure I don't know what you mean."
"I'm sure you do. You and your husband are harboring her. Don't think I'll forget it."
He had the Randolph. He was irritable, jealous, suspicious, and habitually indulgent of the meanest little passions. But I was a Jefferson, so I merely announced, "Anne and I will retire now to leave you gentlemen to your business. Ambassador Melly Melly, I look forward to spending a lively winter with you." Having observed that even a perfumed man wished to be thought manly, I added, "I'm sure you'll be the lion of the season." Lion. The ambassador liked that word. He liked the comparison. I could see the pleasure of it light in his eyes when the interpreter whispered it in his ear. And later, he joined me and Anne in the drawing room, leaving the other gentlemen behind. Anne and I started to rise, but he waved us back into our chairs and surprised us with nearly perfect English.
"We're not the only delegation here in Washington, no? I've seen bands of people not so fair."
For a moment, I thought he meant the slaves. But then he gestured to the feather in his turban.
"Ornaments and buckskin. Long dark braids."
"Indians," I answered, and when he squinted, I added, "are Indians. They've come from the Western Territories to speak with my father."
"Which prophet do they follow?"
he asked, showing Anne a diamond snuffbox to charm her.
"Moses, Jesus, or Mohammed?"
"None," my timid Anne offered, and I was so proud of her for finding courage to speak to the man. "The Indians worship the Great Spirit, as I understand it." The ambassador took a pinch of the snuff, which smelled like roses.
"Then they're vile heretics. Another thing interests me, Mrs. Randolph. In your Congress, where your husband serves, everyone has the right to speak."
"The members do, yes," I replied. He laughed.
"Then it would take years to finish any business. In my country, all matters are decided swiftly and with final resolution. In fact, if I don't succeed in my mission here, they'll behead me."
I wasn't sure I believed him, but he was such a colorful character that everyone was eager to meet him. Invitations to every fashionable ball in Washington City were extended to the delegation, and curious onlookers gawked near the hotel to get a peek at turbans, long mustaches, and ceremonial garb. Given the fascination, I worried we wouldn't be able to admit all the guests who flocked to Papa's annual New Year's Eve gala.
"Will you dance?"
Tom asked at the gala, dressed in his best blue tailcoat. "I'm quite near my time now," I told my husband. "I'd feel like a stampeding buffalo." Tom brought my fingertips to his lips for a brief but very earnest kiss.
"Never."
Nearby, Jack Epps was laughing with a flirtatious woman from Annapolis. He was courting again, and Papa said we must be happy for him. I agreed, because I feared we might never see my sister's children again if we didn't lavish approval on her widower. But Jack's laughter, and the music, were interrupted dramatically by the ambassador of Tunisia, who stopped dancers mid-twirl. With a flourish of his colorful cape that mesmerized the crowd, he let his interpreter speak for him.
"The ambassador has heard that the Madisons desire children, but have been unable to conceive them.
Rarely shy of attention, Dolly smiled and murmured something about how she'd welcome any blessing God were to bestow. Striding to her, the bearded ambassador said,
"If you want a child, I'll give you one."
Then he wrapped the cape around her with such intimacy that her husband, the diminutive Secretary of State, stiffened and went white. Confused by the reaction, the ambassador explained,
"It's a magic cape."
But his words didn't carry, accented as they were. And as the room went silent, men reached for their ceremonial swords in anticipation of violence. I swallowed, wondering which of the men would break the mounting tension in the room. And when I realized that none of them would, I knew that there was no choice but to take it upon myself. Clapping my hands, as if delighted in the way of a child, I cried, "Oh, a magic cape!" My father, the man of science who had decried a reign of witches, looked entirely appalled. But upon seeing me smile and clap, all the other ladies quickly followed suit. Papa could scarcely keep the displeasure from his presidential expression, but he would simply have to endure it. It was a New Year's Eve party, a night for frivolity, and if offense could be avoided by laughter and merriment, why not? Besides, I was the hostess here, so I pretended at great fascination when the ambassador murmured an incantation over Dolly, declaring,
"I promise you, Mrs. Madison, you'll soon give your husband a son."
Everyone applauded the spectacle. Dolly was very amused. When everyone else had gone home for the night, she grabbed at my elbow, grinning. "Why, I've never seen Mr. Madison go so white before. As exciting as it might have been to see men duel over my honor, I suppose I must thank you for averting an international incident. But I must know one thing." Still holding Tom's arm, I asked, "What's that?" Dolly grinned mischievously. "Is that your secret? A magic cape? Given your brood of children, I suppose you must have a closet full of them."
"There are no capes involved," Tom said quite seriously.
Dolly and I found this so terribly funny that we exploded with laughter, which prompted him to accuse,
"You've been drinking, both of you."
For whatever reason, that seemed terribly funny, too. I hadn't laughed since my sister's death, and it felt disloyal to do so. But Dolly was irrepressible.
"I'm afraid I don't put much stock in the ambassador's incantation.
Well, you ought to give it a try anyway," I said, scandalizing my husband utterly.
"With or without the capes?"
Days later, I gave birth to the very first baby ever born in the president's mansion. A boy at last. And Tom had no objection to the name that would give Dolly the most pleasure, James Madison Randolph. "A son," my husband kept saying, as if astonished that it had finally come to pass. At long last, Jeff had a little brother. And we were happy. For a brief enchanted winter in the spacious rooms of the president's house, we forgot our troubles in Virginia. I hosted nearly 63 dinners at my father's side, including one before the day I gave birth and one after. But when I couldn't be there to soothe partisan tempers, my daughter Anne was there in my place. More beautiful and less sarcastic than me in every way. And I made certain she was aware that every dinner and every lady's tea was a mission to beat back the calumny heaped upon Papa's head by his enemies.
"Have you seen this?"
my father's new secretary asked, timidly offering me a clipping from some newspaper.
"I apologize for bringing something so indelicate to your attention, but..."
"You did quite right to show me," I said, burning to read the filthy poem.
the patriot fresh from freedom's councils come. Now plead retires to lash his slaves at home, or woo perhaps some black Aspasia's charms, and dreams of freedom in his bondmaid's arms.
There was a cartoon, too, called A Philosophic Cock, a drawing of my father as a French rooster and Sally as his hen, all part of a campaign to tarnish his image as a devoted father, doting grandfather, and father of this nation. I went straight to Papa with it in a flash of temper, stunned to hear him laugh. How can you laugh at this, Papa?
What else is there to be done? It's demeaning, it's petty, it has nothing whatsoever to do with the business of the country. And they're spilling their ink on it while Republicans trounce them in every election. Unless you think I should call them out onto a field of honor, there's nothing to do but laugh.
Soothed, I gave a soft smile. We're done with pistols now, aren't we? He stood, still tall and straight, grasping my hand.
Yes, we're done with pistols now.
But in that, we couldn't have been more mistaken. Chapter 31. Washington, 23 June, 1806. From Thomas Jefferson to Thomas Mann Randolph, Jr.
Should they lose you, 7 children, all under the age of discretion and down to infancy, would be left without guide or guardian, but a poor, broken-hearted woman, doomed herself to misery the rest of her life. And should her frail frame sink under it, what is to become of them? The laws of dueling are made for lives of no consequence, not for fathers of families. Let me entreat you, then, my dear sir. Take no step in this business, but on the soberest reflection.
A shadow of death hung over us that summer in Virginia. A neighbor was found dead in his carriage. He'd drunk himself to death. More devastating was the murder of Papa's law teacher, Judge Wythe, whose jealous nephew poisoned him, his manumitted black housekeeper, and her free-born mulatto son, to whom Judge Wythe intended to leave his fortune. The judge lived only long enough to tell physicians, "I am murdered." The nephew stood trial, but black witnesses weren't permitted to testify, not even the housekeeper who survived the poisoning, and the villain had been promptly acquitted. Papa took it hard. Not only, I think, because he'd lost a friend and justice was thwarted, but also because it was a repudiation of Judge Wythe and Mr. Short's idealistic dreams of racial coexistence in Virginia. A warning almost tailor-made to discourage my father from bringing Sally and their children out from the shadows. And then, of course, there was Randolph of Roanoke. Was there ever a more deranged example of Virginia gentry in decay? The spiteful creature had singled out my family to torment. In protest of my father's programs for public education, canals, bridges, and roads, he broke with the Republicans to create a brand new political party called the Quids. And when that didn't achieve his aims, he provoked a quarrel with my husband on the floor of Congress. Admittedly, Tom had been rash, putting himself forth as a more true patriot, and when his apology was deemed insufficient, adding,
"Lead and steel make more proper ingredients in serious quarrels."
Sensing an opportunity to provoke 2 very public men to duel, the papers took sides, spilling a barrel of ink on the subject. The National Intelligencer defended Tom, while the Richmond Inquirer championed John Randolph. And the dangerous intensity of my husband's temper sent all the children fleeing whenever he entered a room. They knew to stay out of their father's way while he paced, fulminating at every new accusation. I didn't blame my husband for his anger. Truly, I didn't. I felt certain John Randolph had been trying to goad my husband into a duel for a very long time. I only wished Tom wasn't so easy to goad. "It's because of me," Nancy said, packing up her meager belongings. "If I'm not living here, John might leave my brother alone." I think she hoped I'd stop her, reassure her that she was mistaken in leaving us. But she had the right of it. "Where will you go?" "To Richmond," Nancy said. "We have other relations there. I'll go visiting for a time and see about seeking employment as a housekeeper there." Tom was appalled by the very idea that any sister of his should seek employment. But given Nancy's ruined reputation, she had few options. Tom was a Randolph. He saw himself as wealthy landed gentry, even if our house at Edgehill had fallen to pieces in our absence. It needed repairs and plaster if it was to prove good against any kind of weather, and with the new baby, Edgehill felt smaller and more cramped than ever. That's to say nothing of the drought. The oats were lost. The peaches and cherries, too. We might only have another sickly wheat crop and apples. We weren't in any position to support his sister, so Tom gave Nancy money, more than we had to give, and let her go off to Richmond. Before climbing into the carriage, Nancy gave me a quick hug and whispered, "Try not to worry about the duel. The Randolph temper burns hot, but sometimes burns itself out." I hoped she was right. But when my husband returned from Richmond, he was in a worse state than before. He considered it his sacred duty to care for his sisters and felt unmanned by his inability to do so. And when I found my husband in the yard sighting his pistols and practicing his paces, I realized his temper wasn't going to burn out. He was going to kill or be killed, and I could no longer keep my peace. "So you're going to let him murder you and leave me a widow?" Tom turned on me.
"You think I'll fail at this like I've failed at everything. It's a wonder you don't want me dead."
Given how happy we'd been only months before, this caught me utterly by surprise. "Tom, how could you ever think that I wished such a thing? What would I do without you?"
Tom gave a bitter twist of his beautiful mouth. "Turn to your father like you always do. He can do no wrong in your eyes, whereas I..."
"Well, my father found a way to avoid a senseless duel, didn't he?" I shouldn't have said it. Should never have taken that tone. And the reward for my foolishness was a resounding slap to the face. It didn't knock me to the ground. It wouldn't bruise me. But because it made me feel like both a desperate wife and a chastened child, I stood there gawping in shock, holding my face where it turned red. My husband hadn't struck me since the last time he was in a fit of rage, inspired by one of the Randolph brothers of Bazaar. And now, Tom seemed just as shocked as I was, his eyes filling with shame at the sight of me holding my stinging cheek. With tears in his eyes, he shouted,
"God damn it, Martha! Look what you've made me do! Look what you made me do!"
He never dueled John Randolph. But it wasn't because of my father's letter or my pleas, or because good sense prevailed. It was because he'd struck me, in spite of his promise never to do so again. He'd dishonored himself in his own eyes, and in so doing lost all appetite for a duel of honor. I knew this, deep down where we know such things about the men we marry, and counted it well worth the price. I would have provoked him to strike me 1,000 times to keep him from dooming our family to utter ruin, But the price I didn't understand was one exacted from Tom's soul. For he was never without his pistols ever after, and I feel certain he was keeping a bullet ready for himself. He had inside him the kind of wound that left a man staring at pistols in the night, the kind of wound that left a man without a head, lying on the ground with a gun in his hand, the kind of wound the men in my life all seemed to suffer. And for the first time, I wondered if those wounds were put there by God, or if it was something about me that brought them about. Washington City, 2nd July, 1807. A Proclamation by Thomas Jefferson.
During the wars among the powers of Europe, the United States of America have observed neutrality. At length, a deed transcending all we've hitherto seen or suffered brings our forbearance to a necessary pause. A frigate of the United States, trusting a state of peace, has been attacked by a British vessel of war. This was not only without provocation or justifiable cause, but committed with the avowed purpose of taking by force a part of her crew.
An attack, an insult, an act of war. Publicly, my father prepared for battle. Privately, he confided we weren't ready. The fate of our nation was, as always, caught between England and France, and my father no longer harbored a preference for either, observing,
"France is a conqueror, roaming over the earth with havoc, and Britain is a pirate, spreading misery and ruin over the ocean. Fortunately for us, the mammoth cannot swim nor the leviathan move on dry land, and if we keep out of their way, they cannot get at us."
Thus came about the Embargo Act of 1807. Did Papa know he put the fate of the nation in the hands of its ladies? If we couldn't buy tea, clothes, or goods from overseas, then wives and daughters would have to make them at home. And if women weren't willing, the embargo would fail. After all, what did men know about making homespun? I set about straight away to oversee the production of cloth both at Edgehill and Monticello, where we transformed the stone workman's house into a weaver's cottage. And in this endeavor, I found an ally in Sally Hemings, who'd always been a talented seamstress, and whose six-year-old daughter Harriet was becoming one, too. I tried never to think that fair and freckled Harriet was my sister, but was pleased at how well the girl took to the spinning jennies, and was so impressed by her deft use of the flying shuttle on the clattering loom that I could scarcely pull my attention away when Sally said,
"With the help of the women who don't get put in the ground come harvest, we can make 1,000 yards of cloth by springtime."
To that end, Sally and her children moved from a slave cabin into the weaver's cottage, using another room in the southern dependency by the dairy, too. And as naturally as that, she defined for herself on the plantation a home and office of her own. After that, I decided my children could do no less for the effort than hers. I told Anne, "We're all going to learn to manufacture cloth. In the meantime, look through your dresses and put away anything that wasn't made at home." My eldest had recently caught the eye of the young and dashing Charles Bankhead, who'd complimented her on the fashionable dresses she'd worn when we'd attended dinners at the president's house. And now that she had a suitor, Anne wanted nothing to do with my scheme.
"Slaves wear homespun. How will we look wearing such things?"
"We'll look like patriots," I said with a reassuring smile. Anne pouted.
"Charles won't like it. I don't see why I should have to."
I kissed the top of her head, "Because you're the president's granddaughter." And that was that. From tattered flags and uniforms to friendships strained to the brink, the women of my country had always been the menders to all the things torn asunder. But now we'd do more than patch with needle and thread.